everybody. It's Robert, and I'm sitting here with
Kyle.
And we're at Pearl and Pine Brewery, and I really appreciate Matt and the crew allowing us to come here and do the taping and stuff that we do in Sonora, Georgia. And if you're not familiar with this area south of Atlanta, make sure you come by, check out this place. It's co-owned by an 82nd Airborne veteran and terrific beer. Stop by, say hello. So today we're joined by Jake. And Jake, man, we're just glad that you came all this way and to share your time with us. And
no worries.
Yeah.
It's great to be here.
And you know this guy personally.
Long time no see. This, for those that don't know, Jake was my first sergeant when I first joined the Army, first unit, Anvil Troop 191. If it's Friday, it's on point, motherfucker.
It's on point, motherfucker. It's true. You know, they still do that.
They do?
That's one thing that's kind of cool about that squadron. They've maintained all the troop names. Yeah. And the one thing is Anvil Troop still maintains, you know, on point and on Fridays, on point, motherfucker.
It's ready to go.
Awesome.
So a little bit about Jake. Jake is currently a CSM in the United States Army.
I'm the Sergeant Major for ACM, Recon, and ABCT. So okay. I work in Maneuver Seated, okay, Fort Moore, Georgia. And we're responsible for everything for armor and reconnaissance formations moving forward to, you know, Army 2030, Army 2040.
Oh, wow.
So that's what we do.
Is it hard for you to say Fort Moore?
No, actually,
it is
not.
For me.
So,
yeah.
So Fort Benning was my second duty station when I joined. So I joined in 1996 out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My first duty station was Fort Polk, Louisiana. And I always thought that the installation was named after the president.
Yeah.
I PCS'd to Fort Benning in March of 1999, and I didn't know anything about what Benning was. And so I had to use this thing called the library and a Dewey Decimal System, and I had to look it up. And I looked up who this Benning guy was, and I was like, holy cow, this guy's a piece of shit. He really was. He wasn't, you know, Benning was not a good person. He was big on succession. He was huge on slave ownership. He wasn't, you know, not that there could be a good slave owner, but he didn't believe in any type of, you know, well-being or anything like that for that. And so I remember calling my dad, and, you know, back home, he had to use this rotary telephone thing too. And say, hey man, like, you know, why is it these posts? Cause then he started looking into it. Like, why are these posts named after these Confederate, you know, secessionist rebel scumbags, you know, because I'm from the North. So when you hear the sound of my voice, that's the sound of victory. Right. And, you know, you just come to a conclusion. It was, you know, it was kind of like the North was like, hey, if we let the South name these posts after these Confederates, you know, they'll feel better about having this federal occupation in the Southern states. Because that's basically what it was, you know, when the initial thing. And then when, of course, when you name the post in 1918, you know, it's still this weird stuff going on.
I've always heard that the city of Vicksburg never like celebrated 4th of July till like after 1950.
I've heard that as well.
Yeah. Like there was a lot of hatred back then.
Absolutely.
It seems almost like a peace offering or appeasement at some point.
Yeah. Like, that's kind of what it came down to, is what I've always understood. Like, but the one I never, you know, like when you start looking at the people they name stuff after, and then you start reading, you know, if you read your history, you know, Braxton Bragg wasn't that good of a general. Yeah. You know, Hood really wasn't that great. You know, there's a book out there. It's, you know, the Confederacy's Last Stand. And it was General Hood trying to make the defend against Sherman. Yeah. You ask the people of Georgia in 1864 how well he did. I'm pretty certain they'd tell you I'm not that great.
What unit were you at Fort Polk?
I was in the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment.
Okay.
So I was where I was at. When I got there in 96, the regiment had just moved back from Europe. It was an interesting time because we were an armored cavalry regiment with Humvees, 50 cals, Mark 19s, you know, anti-tank companies with tow launchers and you name it. So it was...
Is that when they had like the 12-truck scout platoon?
Those were in a task force scout platoons. Yeah. They were 10-truck scout platoons. Yeah. I was in one of those too. So like, wow. I'm one of the few remaining, you know, I people make fun of me because it's not really a true ACR that I was in, but I think I'm one of the few remaining 19 series guys in the United States Army to have served in every formation that you can as an armor guy. I've been a battalion scout platoon, BRT. I've done the heavy div cav. I've done the ultra light. And then I was a striker squadron command sergeant major too. Wow. But if I'm going to introduce myself, I have to do this. I am a proud Army parent, and we're incredibly proud of our kids. Our oldest daughter is married to an Alabama National Guardsman, and is our next door neighbor. And then my middle one is a 2020 graduate from West Point and is a logistician officer who's on her way to the captain's career course at Fort Gregg Adams, formerly Fort Lee. And then my son is a specialist about to become a sergeant, 15 Romeo Apache maintainer out at Joint Base Lewis-McChord on his way to Fort Wainwright, Alaska.
Wow. So you really do have deep Army.
Yeah, I figure if you're going to do it, you know, you got to, if you're going to go, you can go hard. Right? You go hard in the paint. What's crazy is like that. All those choices by those young adults now was solely on theirs. You know, there was never any push. I can still remember the day my daughter said, I want to go to West Point. And it was like looking at your wife, like, what did she just say? Did she want to go to West Point? And she went to West Point. Then we actually held our son back from joining, you know, a couple of years, because I remember like looking at him saying like, man, like you're the kid that I chapter out. Right. But they wanted to do it. And you know, I think one of the reasons why I do is because they recognize that the Army is really a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, it provides, it takes, it, at the end of the day, it truly takes care of you. It builds you. It makes you, you know, go from a kid to an adult. You know, I think it, you know, all the, you know, you take the seven Army values and put it all together. It produces a really good human being and a great part of our society. And I think they saw that and saw the opportunity to do it. It doesn't come without struggles. I mean, being an Army parent, especially as a senior Army parent, for anybody who's out there that does this, there are times where it becomes very difficult to delineate between dad and sergeant major. You know, the kids will call me and they'll start off with asking this question, and I'll have to be like, hey, hold on, Brandon, who do you want to talk to right now? Do you want to talk to dad, or do you want to be specialist Stockdale and sergeant major Stockdale? Because we got to have that. Same thing with my daughter. And, you know, I'll do it to her. I'll be like, ma'am. And she'll stop on the phone and be like, dad, you know, I'm your daughter. You are, but you're a commissioned officer in the United States Army. I'm a non-commissioned officer in the United States Army. You know, which one are you talking to right now? I need to know, because there's going to be two different answers. Like, I deployed my squadron to Operation Hammer Resolve in 2019, 2020. It was wonderful. It was supposed to be 9 months, ended up being 11 because of COVID, right? My daughter graduated West Point in the summer of 2020, went to Bullock, blah, blah, blah. I don't know if you remember him, but he was probably before, but Captain Pete Gilbert was our distro company commander. He was now the brigade commander for the CSSB at the 101st. Mm. He was able to grab her from strike and get her downrange. So she's in Erbil, you know, less than a year after I just left this place. You know, and she would call and she would ask questions, and I'd have to tell her all the time, like, who are you talking to? And then she would say something like, hey, you know, they got mortared and they got rocketed and they took a suicide UAV to the FOB. And she calls me up. She's like, hey, you know, I'm trying to work on, you know, this, you know, the paperwork for a cab and all this other stuff. I'm like, hold on, stop. Who do you want to talk to? Are you talking to dad? Or are you talking to Sergeant Major? She goes, I'm talking to dad. I said, oh, Morgan, that's, you know, I'm just glad you're okay. You know, you do whatever you have to do. And she stops on the phone. She goes, okay, what's Sergeant Major say? All right, Lieutenant, if you really think you earned a combat action badge for being on the location that took some indirect fire, then you go right ahead and submit that paperwork. But I'm going to tell you that it's going to get to somebody like me, and they're going to say denied. She's like, why would you do that? I said, Morgan, do you really want to talk about what your dad did to earn his stuff? No, not really. Okay. But because they're adults, you know, they figured out. And that's what I use those stories all the time, because that's how I look at soldiers. I'm 50 years old. I look at soldiers like they're my kids, you know, and if we don't put the time and effort into them, you know, the other line I always use is, you know, if you want the song to ring true, you know, that the Army's going to continue rolling along, then we've got to reinvest as, you know, as seniors to make it happen.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. A lot of that I can attest to. I didn't realize first sergeants just came and grabbed dudes and said, go to lunch. But that's what happened. Like, you're like, you new guys, you guys are going to lunch with me today. Fuck, what is this dude gonna do? And we just had a conversation. Just had a talk. We talked about flag football. You know, and it's just that constant reaching down that not only you portrayed in 191, but also the other leaders that are constantly reaching down and grabbing guys and, hey, come check this out. Come do this. Come try this.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that Blackhawks were rare for training. because we got them for training and there. They went out of their way to get extra resources and do things that I kind of took for granted when I was there, honestly.
Yeah, so one of the things I look back on, you know, in serving in Europe, and it's different now because it's not the same European army. It's just, excuse me, it's not the same. You don't have people like me. I served my first time in Europe. I served for 10 straight years. Now, part of that was because the army said you're going to stay here. And part of it was because we made a choice to stay there. And I mean, it's not hard to choose to stay in Europe. I mean, yeah. It's amazing. But what serving overseas does, and I think if you would talk to anybody who's in the 173rd right now or in 2CAV mm-hmm. or 21st TSC, you know, the main units are over there, you have these common bonding moments. Number one, you know, Sprech Deutsch 9. Like, I can't speak German. And I was probably really bad at saying that. But, you know, you don't speak German. Mm-hmm. You know, so the guys in the barracks have to be tight because everybody speaks English. And more importantly, it sounds crazy, but like, you can drink beer at 18. So that divide that normally happens with like young sergeants and senior specialists to privates because they're going to the club to get their drink on and they have to stay at the barracks, you know, doesn't happen. Everybody's there. And then if you do another thing that I always say, you treat people like adults and expect adult results, you're going to get it. One of my proudest things of being that troop first sergeant is I had, you know, I shouldn't say I had, but you know, it's the way you do it. But like, the troop had zero alcohol or drug related incidences in the 36 months that I was a troop first sergeant. I would go to the sergeant major meetings in the morning and it was like B troop with all these chapter packets or all these UCMJ things, C troop, UCMJ, D troop, UCMJ, HHT, UCMJ. And here, and I can remember sergeant major looking at me like, what are you doing? That's so much different. I'm like, sergeant major, I treat them like adults, you know? And that's one of the problems with our leadership that's not involved with their mm-hmm. soldiers is they start, you know, having these adult expectations, but we treat them like children, right? So, I mean, if you went home and your kids are 10 years old and you expected them to do the laundry, do the dishes, take the trash out, wash the car, mow the grass, and that was your expectation of them at 10, you would always be disappointed. Mm-hmm. But if you expected them to make their bed, brush their teeth, you know, wipe their ass, then you'd probably be very satisfied and be like, look at my kid. He's doing great things, right?
Yeah.
But we just continue to, and when you continue to, that's where this toxicity, I think, comes mm-hmm. from. That's probably the first part where we start seeing toxicity is like, I expect that something's going to happen. You know, the doer doesn't do what the doer, you know, the checker doesn't check what the checker needs to check kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The doer only does what the checker checks, right? There's no checking mm-hmm. going on. And then there's this expectation that it's just going to happen. Like, it's going to miraculously, you know, appear in the motor pool that all my vehicles have been maintained. Well, if you weren't down there,
yeah,
if you weren't there having lunch, you know, the flag football thing, I'm a firm believer that we should be doing more organized sports. Because you learn so much about your formation.
I think it's an easy way to build camaraderie too.
Absolutely. Competition is my humble opinions again is like the backbone of what we do. Like, nobody, we say it all the time. Nobody goes to, you know, General Milliam would say it all the time, you know, we're never going to play a home game. Okay, cool. We're never going to play a home game. Ask the Kansas City Chiefs about playing away, going in the Buffalo. You know, I hate the Kansas City Chiefs. I don't hate them. I'm a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, but like, you know, they went into Buffalo and they won. Why? Because they were tight as a team through competition, all these intrinsic, they had realistic expectations. They treated each other like adults. You know, they had adult result expectation and they went in there and were able to do it. So through sport, you can see these things. You can build that camaraderie, build that competition, and it's a healthy competition.
Yeah.
Especially if you have the leaders that want to be there and be with their soldiers. It's not, hey, we're going to go kick the shit out of B troop or, you know, we're going to beat down CECO. Hey, we're going to go beat CECO and we're going to make them better because they're going to want to, they should have leadership that wants to come back like, man, I can't stand A troop.
There was a lot of that for a good reason. A lot of the things that I realized were kind of done. There's a famous picture out there, and this is something that I wasn't part of, but it was, who was the captain at the time?
Captain Kelly.
Captain Kelly.
Tim Kelly.
So they found a canoe chained to a tree at Graffenveer, and they made the coolest picture ever, where they got all of headquarters stone, and they made a recreation of Washington crossing the Delaware.
No way.
That's cool.
So the long story of this is we're doing a graph rotation. So for people to understand, when you're stationed in Germany, you're stationed in Europe, the home station, like your gunnery type ranges, aren't in your back 40. Like right. you don't just go out to East Fort Hood, or sorry, Fort Cavasso. You don't just go out to the training area at Fort Moore. You have to go down to Graffenveer training area, which is in Eastern Bavaria. It's, you know, maybe 25, 30 kilometers ish from the Czech Republic border. Right. But it's a great training area. It really is. But you go to Cantonment area. I think it's called Aachen, where they have barracks and all that stuff. Well, we went down there and there were some contract issues with dumpsters. So then Specialist Fasha is my driver of my truck. And so I would have to bring trash back from a range, and we were searching for a dumpster to put trash in. And like, we were turning around from the dumpster. I'm like, whoa, stop. And Foster was like, what? I said, that's a canoe. And he's like, what do you want to do with the canoe? And I wanted to take the canoe back out to the range, but something in my tingly sergeant, you know, first sergeant sense is like, probably not a good idea. So I know this canoe is there, and I knew instantly what I wanted to do, and it was to recreate Washington crossing the Delaware. Like, I knew it from the point, and I'm not one of those guys that has, like, you know, artistic vision in my head with colors and all that stuff. But I came back and I just talked to a couple people and was like, yes, we're doing this. And so it ended up being like the headquarters platoon, mm-hmm. the platoon sergeants and platoon leaders, and we got on there and we recreated Washington. And it's still out on the interwebs. You can probably, yeah. I don't know if you can Google it and find it, yeah, you know, but it's out there. And it was, but that does, I mean, that's a great point. Yeah. Like that encapsulated, I think he's the right word there. Like that's what that troop was.
Yeah. And he could have had every right to just throw the trash away and like go back and start yelling at people at the range. But you thought of something. It's funny. Yeah. But it's also a bonding moment.
Yeah.
And then what else from that graph rotate? Y'all ran out of meat, or no, y'all ran out of food. So y'all had steak for like 4 days.
So I'm a firm believer in relationships, right? So, I mean, you know, whether it's in the army world or mm-hmm. the civilian world, the business world, whatever, it's all about relationships. Like, it's like the golf course thing. You know, you can play 18 holes of golf, all the work gets done in the 19th hole. Right. You're building up to get to the 19th hole to go in there and have a cocktail with a guy. And mm-hmm. that's where work gets done. Right. I was really good friends with the DFAC. I've had great respect for the DFAC. You know, these 92 golfs, they work the worst hours in the army. They get shit on all the time. They're, you know, it's the same thing with the expectation. Like, you know, soldiers have this expectation. These other soldiers are going to be culinary experts and make, you know, 5-star meals out of 1-star product. Right. Well, one of the UGRAs, the meals for breakfast, comes with breakfast steaks. And so I would work it to where the guy would just let me have my breakfast steaks. And so at that point in time, I also had an Arctic back, high back Humvee, right? And so I had a grill back there. I had all the stuff at the troop store in the back. We would grill at every single range. And so we had tons of steak. And so we had, oh man, I'm probably getting in trouble for this. The backside of this whole thing is they have the range calendar. And on one of the days, it was like a Monday, we weren't able to shoot because it was a German holiday. Well, on the thing, it says it was Gerhol, Gerhol. And I convinced the troop commander that it was the one of the most important German holidays ever, that it was very similar to Festivus.
That's great.
And so we went out and had feats of strength. And one of our feats of strength was a steak eating contest.
Just those little anecdotal stories are just one of those things that.
But you know what made that work in that organization at that point in time with that troop is I go back to it, treating people like adults mm-hmm. and expecting adult results, and then holding people accountable for when, you know, like we were talking about before, you know, can't, won't, don't, you know, mistakes of omission versus mistakes of commission. I think that what was built in that organization for the, you know, those first couple years I was there was that it was, that was the pressure. The pressure was, if we want to to party hard on Friday and Saturday, we got to work hard, you know, Monday through Friday afternoon. You know, so if we did what we were supposed to do during the week, during the training event, during the guard duty, during the flag detail, during picking up trash in the motor pool, whatever it was, if we did it right, you know, measured twice, cut once, then we'd be able to do the other things on the other side.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of those ones, like we talk about the sport. So our flag football team for the troop was pretty good. I think Delta Troops was better. Russell was, I mean, that kid, God rest his soul, that kid could play quarterback, man. It was insane.
He missed his calling. I truly believe he missed his calling.
This kid was Manziel before Manziel was even around. I mean, he was just so good. But he was a good soldier, and he got killed in Afghanistan in 2011. But he was just a great kid. But Delta Troop was the other troop, and that was our competition. We were supposed to play a playoff game to go to USERA. And if we'd have lost the game, we were still going to go to USERA because it was for the Schweinfurt community, first and second place. Like, it was guaranteed it was going to be Delta Troop 191 Cav and Alpha Troop 19 Cav. We had an airborne operation we had to go to. And everybody's like, but we gotta play this playoff game. I'm like, no, man. Like, that we get paid to jump out of airplanes, and we're gonna go down to Grafenwehr, and we're gonna do what we're supposed to do because this is the way it works. Our primary duty is to be soldiers, not football players. We can't get it rescheduled because the community wasn't willing to reschedule the game, so we went down there. But like, I use that one all the time because initially I think everybody was pretty pissed. I mean, it was disappointing. It was disappointing to me.
Yeah.
But I truly believe that on the backside of it, because of the accountability that was in that organization the whole time, and because leaders were involved and they were bought into the order, like, it wasn't just headquarters told me I was going to do this. Now that staff sergeant was saying, hey, we're doing this because I said we're doing it, that we were able to move past that and just kind of look back and like, hey, man, we could have been something else. We could have done something else. But what we did do is we maintained our proficiency at, you know, falling from an aircraft at 1,000 feet. And crashing into the planet because people like us are just planet smackers. There is no such thing as a dynamic PLF.
Yeah. 11 out of the door, first on the ground.
Right. When you're 230 pounds, like, it is all planet smacking.
There's all of my jumps can be, they're going to archaeological evidence because there's craters in the ground.
Yeah, there are trees that I've hit in Grafenwehr that are probably leaning in opposite direction they're supposed to right now. But that's, I mean, it all comes back to, I mean, I hate, you know, you boil it down. Like, it's just, it's all about that accountability piece. Like, right. if you hold people accountable and then reward them, you know, another one thing I say all the time, like the least expensive words in the United States Army are thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're for some reason, you know, we talk about the toxic leaders.
Yeah.
That's like, it must be the hardest words from them to ever say is thank you. Or, you know, I'm sorry. You know, taking accountability for your own actions. You know, like, man, I screwed that up.
I'm
that
sorry from fault. A leader goes so much further than a thank you, I think. You know what I mean?
Like, absolutely.
I can kind of go without it. I can have a thankless job. That's okay. But if my leader messes up, I feel like them recognizing it is far more important than them recognizing me for a good job.
Yeah.
I mean, that personal accountability, one, is an amicable trait. But two, it lets you know that what you were feeling and what you were doing wasn't off the mark.
Yeah.
It gives you feedback.
And it helps you grow.
Yeah.
When you're a subordinate and you're going to emulate your leaders, right? And you're going to take something from every piece, whether they're good or bad. You know, and I can go back in time and I can see former platoon sergeants that were good, and I do a lot of it, and I can see ones that were bad. And I'm like, I don't ever want to be like that. You know, my number one mentor, and I don't know if you ever met him, was Steve Zebarth. So he was my platoon sergeant when I got to Schweinfurt, ended up being my first sergeant, you know, but I tried to emulate Sergeant Zebarth and in so many things, you know, because like I do now, accountability. You know, General McMaster was my squadron commander at the time, and it's a funny one. Like, I got there, I met the squadron commander, we're getting ready to go to Graf to shoot gunnery, and I'd never shot gunnery on a Bradley before. And he said, hey, you got a Q1, because if you Q2, you know, if you get in Q1 is you qualify the first time downrange, Q2 is, you know, subsequent times, right? If you Q2, you'll find yourself in support platoon. This is the squadron commander. And part of it was because, you know, at that point in time, I was the only enlisted Ranger qualified guy in the squadron. I was of 19 Deltas, I was like number 22 or 25 ever. you know, these, and it's just like, there's these kind of external pressures again. Mm-hmm. And so I went back down to the platoon CP and I said, hey, like, you know, SCO said that if I don't qualify for, you know, Q1, if I Q2, he's going to put me in support platoon. And everybody's kind of looked at me like, yeah, that's what's going to happen. And, you know, I think about the again, like today's Army and where we struggle is, I took that as a challenge. I'm like, oh, hell no, I'm not going to go be in support platoon. I'm the damn best scout in this troop, you know, kind of thing. And so I, you know, I grabbed my gunner. I'm like, hey, man, like, we're putting more hours in UCOFT because I had never done this before. And the other one too, you know, for those who don't know what it's like to be in a turret of an armored vehicle, you know, the gunner is the primary controller of the weapon system, but the commander, the tank commander, the Bradley commander, you know, also has engagements. And there's like, there's no way someone else is shooting my stuff. Cause that's what everybody says, oh, don't worry about it. Your gunner will shoot your shit. No, I'm shooting my shit because that's what I'm doing. And I think that that's one of the things where it's not an Army problem. I think it's a societal problem because we've come with this generation of everybody gets a trophy.
Yeah.
You know, Dr. Twenge talks about it, you know, with the, you know, the IGEN and where we are in development of kids, especially males now, like the Gen Xer was doing all kinds of stuff by the time they were 16 that the IGENer is not doing till like 25. And yeah, like pressure, accountability. You just got to do it.
Yeah. And that's going to lead us into kind of something we hit on before we turned everything on was that kind of goes into the readiness piece, right? Like we have just from as a societal readiness, right? We don't have the numbers of able-bodied, able-minded, ready to go people, not even men, just people.
Yeah.
To go do what, a formation in 1990 at in processing probably looks a lot different than a formation in 2024.
Yes. So I think there's, I probably should have wrote this down a note because this is a great question. I don't want to speak for the Army kind of thing, but I think there's a couple of things that, and this is probably for the entire, you know, uniform services. One, you know, we talk about the formation in 1990, we got to go back in time. We got to think like, that kid in 1990, me, I came in the Army in 1996. So my grandfather was a World War II vet, of that generation. So my grandfather's best friend was a guy named Jim McFarland, who was a retired colonel, you know, special forces up the street from us. You know, I think he served at the end of World War II, served in Korea, served in Vietnam, right? But they were all over the place. I mean, we were in the early 90s. I hate saying it this way, but we were putting, you know, 1,000 World War II vets in the dirt a day, right? So the exposure to service was exponentially greater than what it is in 2024. You know, my father's generation was Vietnam, you know, so there was a different, you know, flavor, if you will, towards service, but there was still a massive formation, if you will, of human beings who had served during that period and had continued to serve because the Army was, you know, 2 million strong or something like that in 1969. You know, I'm probably way off on the numbers, but somewhere around there, right? By the time we get to here, where we are today in 2024, you know, we're talking less than 1% of the population serves. So the exposure to the Army, Marine Corps, Navy, and the Air Force is so minimal unless you're in that sphere of influence of that post camper station within the United States. When we look at where soldiers come from, you know, they come from Texas, they come from Georgia, they come from North Carolina,
Ohio,
yeah. You know, they come from places where those, and we're never going to say that word again. That's the landmass between Pennsylvania and Indiana.
Okay.
The only thing that comes out of that place is 4 wins a year with the Bengals and the
Wow, your NFL hate runs deep. Wow,
I am such a Steeler fan, and that's the only reason I went to Ranger school, so I could wear something black and gold on my uniform. but going back to it, so that sphere of influence is so diminished that I don't think that the regular citizen of the United States really understands what we're doing. And then you think about what they see on the media. Like, You know, in 2011, when we're in Afghanistan, if we'd have been stateside versus being, you know, four deployed to Europe and then four deployed to Afghanistan and working on AFN, we would have watched CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, and it was all negative.
It was bad.
Everything that was going on for us was negative. Mm-hmm. But the reality was the Army was, we were asked to do something for our country and we went and did it. But the reality, at the end of the day, the Army paid for my college education. The Army paid for my kids to go to school. The Army put a roof over my head. The Army has paid me very well. And I shouldn't say just paid like monetarily, but it has provided for me immensely. Like it made me who I am. It's made who you are. It made my kids who they are. And this goes on for thousands of us. And that's why this generation now, the warrior generation, you know, we're incredibly similar to Sparta right now. Like the less than 1% is made up by like something like 75% of people who are either had parents that served, grandparents that served, an uncle that served, something like that. Right. So just there. But if I went back to my hometown of Rural Valley, Pennsylvania, and I wore my uniform there, people would be like, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not exposed to it. But if you went downtown Columbus, Georgia, you know, you're wearing your BDUs, wearing your, you know, your, whatever they call it, multi-cam DCUs, or I don't even know what the hell they call it anymore. I'm on my fourth uniform, you know, but you went downtown, nobody blinks an eye.
Mm-hmm.
If you went back to Rural Valley, Pennsylvania, and I did that same thing, they'd be like, what the, who's that guy? Is he hunting? Yeah. What season is it?
Man, we had this conversation last night with Burke and Jarvis. You said 2 points that, one that Jarvis said and one that Burke said. One, the Army provided for you. So the nation really doesn't owe you anything at this point.
No, absolutely not.
And two, Jarvis, I think in a roundabout way, is what you're trying to say is we got to make the military cool again, but in the right ways.
Yeah.
From a standards point, from a out there in the open, like.
Well, that's what I think is like we'd go back to the Army, and I'm sure the same, again, we'll just talk Army. You know, we're a microcosm of society. We are what we are. And what you see today, I mean, let's think about it. Everybody talks about it. It's that everybody gets a trophy generation, you know, and it's not a bad thing. You know, we're trying to make people feel good about themselves and all these other things, but like the Army is not a everybody gets a trophy organization. Like you have to be grounded by those seven Army values, and those seven Army values are a lot of giving. I'm a servant leader. You know, I have given up my time for you. You know, you talked about it. Like I grab up all the new kids to take care of the DFAC, right? One, because DFAC's awesome. I'm going to pay $4 for lunch versus going down to wherever. But you know, the other one is like, again, that's why I think the European world is so much different. Serving like, hey, let's go to the donor stand. I'm going to experience, I'm going to have you experience a donor. I want you to go and have this, you know, because so many people go over there and like, Germany sucked. The beer was okay. The reality is like, man, there is more to it.
Have you been to Kreuzberg?
Yeah.
Have you tried snowboarding? Like, have you done
for real?
Have you done the things like, have you experienced Bavaria for what it is outside of the Army? So
one of the things we did too, is like, this is pre bed and breakfast, but like I was making phone calls and struggling with like, you know, my bleh German, but I would put together like full on week, you know, 5-6 day ski trips down to Austria where I'd get all these people together, you know, and go down and go snowboarding, you know, skiing, you know, to do the Alps. And, and once you get a couple exposed, and that's where it comes down to. Yep. I took a couple staff sergeants down.
And Gio took me.
And then those staff sergeants took their soldiers down, and it just kept on going, you know. But going back to the readiness part, you know, I look at, you know, I think that the Army needs to, through encouragement, I think we go after the wrong person, right? So Jake Stockdale goes off to college. I go to Slippery Rock University of PA in 1992 to go play football, right? I was an okay football player. I mean, I made the team. I lettered the 1 year. I was on the travel team, but I was not the best guy on the field, right? I mean, I can remember sitting there thinking to myself like, oh my gosh, this is D2 football. you know, I can't even imagine what it's like. We played Youngstown State the last year that Trussell was there.
Mm-hmm.
We got beat 52-25, and that was the most points that scored against those guys. I got in for six plays. I played middle linebacker. I remember they broke the huddle, and I'm, you know, you try to start going through your reads. You know, you read through the line, and you try to see the running back to figure out where everybody is to try to have a better idea what's going to happen. It's just like anything else. I couldn't see the running back because it was the first time I'd ever seen a center over 6'2". And I'm pretty certain I said it out loud in my stands, like, what am I doing here? Like, that was the moment I knew, like, this is not for me. You know, I'm okay in flag football, playing for the Army. I'm pretty darn good. Maybe I should go to that. I didn't know that yet. But, you know, I'm not a good college student. I wasn't mentally ready for it. I wasn't disciplined enough to do both things. I allowed all the other distractions to get in my way, and I end up, you know, I don't fail out of college, but I'm smart enough to recognize, like, this is not working. Mm-hmm. I got something else. And that's where the Army came in. I kind of knew I always wanted to be a soldier. I was in ROTC, but the Army picked me up and took care of me. And that's who I think we need to be, like, going after. Like, is the Jake Stockdales of the world that are at college, that are a little bit older, have experienced life, you know, have experienced a little bit of failure, that understand that there's, because then you're going to have some resiliency there. Because that's one of the problems with the everybody has a trophy generation is, like, I feel like, you know, from an Army leader perspective, I have to worry about your resiliency all the time, because that's what comes back into. Like, if I'm going to hold you accountable, you know, and I'm going to be hard on you, I need to know that you're going to be able to bounce back from this.
Yeah.
You know, and now I'm worried, you know, from this readiness perspective. Like, in leader involvement, you know, you can go around and, like, watch PT. Like, the organizations that get it, the organizations that are good, you know, the ones that you, man, those guys are getting after it. They're out there doing PT all the time. Why? Because it's, you know, it's that important, because at the end of the day, that's what we do, right?
Yeah.
We got to be physically ready. You know, I recognize that at 50, I'm not, you know, 25-year-old, you know, Staff Sergeant Stockdale anymore. Like, those days are gone. So,
yeah.
But I still try to hold myself. I personally try to hold myself as accountable as I possibly can in order to meet the standards that I feel that I need to meet.
Mm-hmm.
Right, from a readiness perspective. I think the other problem we have readiness wise is, you know, if we look at it from a .mil PF, right? That's where when we do stuff: doctrine, organization, training, leadership, material, personnel. I probably messed something else in there too. It's an acronym.
Finance?
No, it's
what's the F?
God dang it, I should know this. I know it, but now I lost it. Anyway, I think that we're struggling right now in the T and the L, like the training and the leadership. And that's a symbiotic relationship, right? You know, the leader has to be trained. You have to train the leader. The leader has to be trained and train the leader.
Is sergeant's time training still a thing?
So it comes and goes. It's one of those ones where it just,
I don't understand why that ever went.
So my belief is there was a period in time where sergeant's time training was solely based on individual skills,
yes. Like
individual tasks.
Yes.
Maybe up to the crew level,
yes.
Right? So when I say crew level, like, and place a machine gun, mm-hmm. that's a crew task, you know, put a Bradley turret in operation,
yeah.
Crew task, right? And then all of a sudden, because of all the other shit that was out in the training sphere, sergeant's time training sort of just slowly had mission creep and went from being individual skills, maybe crew task, to collective training. And so it just lost what it just became another day.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just kind of, and we're in the Offergen cycle. You were back for 9 months deployed. You're back for 9 months deployed. Mm-hmm. So I think we lost our way in that. Organizations are trying to bring it back. When I was in 125 in Alaska, we're trying to bring it back and call it leaders time training. But it was the same thing. Like, you're just, you know, we lost one of the reasons why we have a readiness problem is we've kind of lost the art of training management development, you know, understanding the ebbs and flows of the training cycle, you know, the training band of excellence and where we're trying to be. You know, we have, because of the nature of how we replace people, you know, it's from an enlisted side in your regular force comm organization, we feel it the most because the leaders are the ones that are leaving every 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so Lieutenant Colonel Stockdale comes in and he or she wants everything to be at the top. Like, we got to go, 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 go. So we're going to train versus, you know, Staff Sergeant Neal's in his section. He's like, God dang, man, I've done this 100 times. Can we just please slow down?
Yeah.
You know, so then what goes away first. The what we would call the ankle biter training events, sergeant's time goes away. Because why? Because we've been doing all these collective training events all the other time. We can't find, and so just, you know, we go from being able to walk to just trying to run all the time.
Yeah.
Right? Like we should have been training some crawl over here, but because we want to go out and do collective training, you know,
crazy is because when you get to the AAR for the collective training, you're like, why don't you guys know the basics?
Absolutely.
Like, cause,
you know, cause the new SMA, you know, when he got in the position, his line was be brilliant in the basics.
Yeah.
And when I talked to him, I said, you know, one of my lines as a trainer was always, what are you going to do when the batteries go dead?
Yeah.
Right. Cause that's another one of the things where I think where we have a struggle with, you know, new technologies are emerging. So we're going to try to solve our problems with, you know, big M material solutions versus trying to solve problems with, you know, T&L solutions. I'm a firm believer that I think our doctrine's right. I think our organization's right. You know, I think we have the right material right now in many ways. There's things we're behind the power curve on, right? But, you know, I think we need to be training the little things. Like, what do they do when the batteries are dead? Do leaders across the board know how to use a protractor, a compass, and a map?
No.
Do you know how to zero a T&E?
Do you know how to zero a T&E? Do you know how to pick up a weapon system?
Yes.
And make sure it functions to make it, to make it work. You know, are you able to engage the enemy from between 50 to 350 meters? You know, like, can you call for fire again, using a protractor, a compass, and a map? Can you navigate from point A to point B using a protractor, a compass, and a map? Can you do it at night? Can you do it when it's raining? You know,
can you do it without the protractor or the compass or the map? You only have two of the three. Like, right? there's certain things there that if you're not teaching the basics, and if you're not drilling the basics, and if you're not, honestly, the best thing that I was ever told was when your section leader or team leader come into your room for inspections, have all the things written out on your wall.
Yeah.
Could one there, it's going to spark a conversation between them, but two, it's showing them that you're honing the basics and you're listening to the little things. Like, guys like John Greer drilled that into my head. Like, he was, say what you will about him in garrison.
Yeah.
When we were doing the thing, and he was right where he needed to be as far as techniques and tactics. Yeah,
he had some demons.
He had some demons, but tactically he was very, very sound. And he drilled those things into my head. And that's something I carried with him. And it's just the simple stuff.
If you go down the line, like, we're always on somebody's family tree, right? There's the, you know, somebody trained somebody who trained somebody, trained somebody, who trained somebody. And hopefully you're able to maintain, again, it goes back to accountability, you're able to maintain that. Like, that's one of the things I think, you know, when I say I'm jealous of organizations, you know, like, I look at the 75th Ranger Regiment and I'm jealous of them because they are able to maintain this internal pressure that says, hey, I'm going to live by these six stanzas of this creed, and it's going to drive everything I do in my life every single day at my house, in my car, at my work. And when you fall out of line, those guys are going to do everything they can to bring you back in, to get you back in line, to be adhere to those six stanzas. You know, I wish the rest of the Army could be that way.
Well, the difference there, though, is that they have a selection process that makes sure that,
absolutely.
Right? And day you have to earn it. Whereas the conventional Army or the conventional military, it's not the same.
Yeah.
I mean, if I mess up, yeah, you know,
it's hard. But, and so then we go back to the readiness part. So leaders have the tendency a lot of times just be like, oh, well, I'm just going to cut sling load on that guy versus saying, no, I've got to continue working with them. Yeah. You know, I go back to my time in Schweinfurt, Germany. I think one of the reasons why that organization that we were part of was the way it was is because that never took place. You know, that it was always like, hey man, this is what we got. This is what we're going to go to war with. We've got a year to get ready. Like, I think between those two deployments, those that I'm talking about, I think we had like maybe 11 months, you know. It's like, hey man, we've got to build a team. So let's build a team. Let's do this. And so you go to work, you know, and you hold people accountable. I know I sound like a broken record with the accountability piece, but I think when we look at all these problems, when we look at readiness, you know, if we just went to material readiness, right? Like, holding people accountable. I've got to go down to the motor pool and I've got to do my 10 level maintenance.
Yeah.
And then I've got to go with my vehicle to the bay to work with the mechanics to help them do the 20 level maintenance. And then if you're not doing it, I've got to hold you accountable for not doing it. And, and a lot of times, you know, unfortunately, I think one of the problems we have is at the height of the war, we got into a rental fleet type of mentality, right? I was going to train with something at home station, but I was going to deploy and fall in on something downrange. And then there was going to be a contractor that worked on it, right? And so people didn't maintain that attitude. Like I remember Ryan and Abnett.
Yeah.
We changed an A-arm on an MRAP downrange in 2010, and we got in trouble for it because we were supposed to have taken it to the contractors to do that. Like we had voided the contract on the vehicle. And it was kind of like, well, we had the ability to do so. I have great mechanics in this tent bay. We're going to fix this thing. So we fixed it so we could have trucks on the road. You know, we were accountable for our actions. Yeah. I took the ash chewing, you know, and I just rolled off my back because I knew we did the right thing.
Yeah.
Did you feel like though, because I'm just curious, like you came in pre 9/11.
Yeah.
So there was, you know, a different type of approach. You're constantly trying to get your team pumped up for what could happen.
Yeah.
Of course, everybody didn't know for sure if anything was ever going to happen because it had been a long span.
It was a weird time.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at what we have now, it's what's old is new.
Yeah. Right? So we're kind of repeating ourselves in a lot of different ways.
Absolutely.
And we had this conversation in another episode around just that topic alone. I mean, you guys are talking about getting back to the basics of the things that I learned as an early soldier. You learned as an early soldier about protractors and map reading and all those types of basics. We don't know what the next war is going to be.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know what type of conflict it's going to be. But we are starting to notice that the things that our forefathers, like you had mentioned, your grandfather, your dad, and the time periods and stuff they were in, different wars, Korea, Vietnam, World War II, World War I, trench warfare, all of that. So I think it's a little bit more, I would think, a lot more challenging today to be a non-commissioned officer to get that readiness out of individuals who may have just experienced a very different type of war and maybe not understanding why it's so necessary to prepare.
I think what you're getting at is like there's a distraction of material solutions when there's going to be the constant of combat, right? One, it's going to be combat. You know, people get hurt, people get blown up. Like I remember, you know, we were in Afghanistan in 2010. We have, you know, we get into country during the winter time. So the it's slow, right? We're doing our job, but there's very minimal contact. And I had some platoon leaders that were, you know, that I don't think were necessarily getting it. And I brought them into my hooch and I was like, hey man, let me tell you what the worst thing in the world is: the smell of burnt flesh. And they just kind of looked at me like, what are you trying to talk about for a second? I'm like, I'm just telling you, like, when it happens, these are the things that are going to be seared into your memory for the rest of your life. And you're never, ever, ever going to get rid of it, right? That's the reality of combat, regardless of what. And I know there's the generals all talk about, and I can't remember the words right now, the character of combat versus there's another C word. Mind blank. But it's going to be the same. So what I think goes on in today's world is there's so many distractions that keep you from training the basics. And the units that are good, they have leadership that does that. They're lethal because they are good at the basics, and they're lethal because they're held accountable, and they're lethal because there's this challenge out there. It goes back to that pressure, right? I don't want to fail you as my leader. So therefore I'm going to do everything I can to do it right. I'll give a good one. When I came back from Germany in 2011 to Fort Benning, I was in the Inspector General officers, right? I was an IG, which to many people like it was shocking and scary to think that I was
the most poetically justified thing.
It totally was. So I would go out and do briefs to the captain's career course, to the maneuver pre-command course that came through, and you know, all kinds of briefs about like what the IG does, what the role of the IG is, and all that stuff. And I would tell them that they had to be careful with Joe, because just like, I think it was Lethal Weapon 3, and when they're going through the drive-thru and Joe Pesci's in the back, they just always fuck you in the drive-thru, right? I would tell them, Joe will fuck you in the drive-thru, and they're not going to mean to do it, right? And they're just going to do it because they're trying to make you be proud of them. You know, so if you come in as a troop commander or a troop first sergeant or company commander, or company first sergeant, you say, we're going to have a 300 PT score as the company average, and you're a charismatic, like, and you got guys wanting to follow you, you're going to have a young sergeant out there who's going to smoke the dog shit out of his section or his squad or his team, trying to make you happy. But in reality, he's doing everything wrong, and he's fucking in the drive-through because he's being this, you know, overbearing, harassing, tyrannical leader who's just really just trying to do the right thing because you wanted to have a 300 PT score average, right? Versus like, you know, and part of that because you say it as a leader and you don't, you're not involved and you have all the other distractions. Like, you know, there was a point in time where, you know, we had to do all this 350-1 training stuff. And I always said it was an excuse, you know, just get it done. I don't remember ever having a problem getting it done. I mean, I think I might've been a first sergeant, and even as a sergeant major, I just kind of, it's like, whatever, you know, just let's focus on what's important. But, you know, yeah, today's leader is going to struggle with, you know, all the other stuff going around, and there's the distractions of like, you know, man, I really don't want to go there, but I'm going to, you know, we have changed regulatory guidance in the Army that allows for like grooming standards that just everybody gets a trophy, you know? So we have, everybody has a profile for shaving, whether, you know, and I shouldn't say everybody, but they're just, the proliferation of this thing is out there so much now that it just, it makes it difficult for the young NCO, the young commissioned officer, the young leader to say, hey, like, what are you doing? Cause I don't know. I don't know if you have a shaving profile. I don't know if you're a Viking, you know, I don't know if you know, whatever it is. And so you just see, in my opinion, you see this, you know, relaxing of the standard, and it's like, what are we going to do? Because the reality is, if we go and we fight an organization or a country or non-state actor that wants to hit us with freaking chemical agents, I'm living, you guys aren't. I mean, that's the reality. I mean, I don't care how many times we say, oh yeah, I can still get a seal with my mask. I'm pretty certain you can't. Like, I know that I was in Holmesfells one time, and I probably hadn't shaved in 2 days because we just go, and I got hit with CS, and I'm pretty certain I ate all of that can through my mask, and I had like a 2-day beard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We used to have a sergeant major the kid around a Bic.
Single blade
disposable. Yeah. And so, you know, if you were out in the field or even back in garrison, and if you had a profile, you better be able to have it on your person and pull it out.
You can't do that now. That's a HIPAA violation.
Yeah. Otherwise, is that right?
What?
Yeah. I can't ask you if you have a shaving profile.
How?
What?
Why?
Because it's a violation. It basically, it boils down to I'm violating your rights. So what I have to do is I would go to your company commander and first sergeant, like, hey, I saw Specialist Neil. I'm just curious, does he have a shaving profile or a shaving exemption to policy? Yes, he does. Okay.
Wow. That's
the distractions.
Yeah. Like, I can find that's very challenging.
We're taking leadership ability away from leaders. So
I'm at Fort Polk, Louisiana, in 2CAV. I lived in, my first year there, I lived in the barracks as a geographical bachelor. My wife and I got married at my family day at Fort Knox, and I had not gone back and gotten married in the church yet. So we got married 2 times on the same day, just a year apart. It's actually kind of cool. Mm-hmm. July 5th, 1996 and July 5th, 1997. My mom and dad don't know it was July 96. Sergeant Major McGovern was the sergeant major for 3rd Squadron. My barracks were right behind his barracks. And it was literally like out of the movie, right? You know, you'd walk around, you'd see Sergeant Major McGovern, and you didn't want to talk to him. Like, he would walk away. And it wasn't because he was a dick. It's because he was going to find something wrong with you, your uniform.
Yeah.
There was going to be something wrong, and he was going to be like, hey, how come your boots are bloused, you know, 1/8 of an inch below the second eyelet? Sergeant Major, I don't know. You know, so like, talk about like things you want to take away, what you don't. Like, I remember those days. And I'm like, I will never be that guy.
Oh, yeah. Sergeant Major was also the feared guy for a reason. Kept discipline.
But what's crazy is, and I was not prepared for this as a squadron sergeant major. I was not prepared for how accessible I really was. Right. Like I expected to be talking to first sergeants and platoon sergeants and staff sergeants. And what it ended up being is like no one was afraid to talk to Sergeant Major anymore. It wasn't a bad surprise, but it was a good surprise. And I deployed, you know, to Iraq. And so I had the majority of the guys we deployed with were at the squadron FOB. And so you realize you're there and you're starting to play this game of like, hey man, like if I'm the one out there all the time, you know, what about first sergeant? Like, you know, am I taking away from first sergeant's ability to influence their troop and trying to, you know, it was OIR. It wasn't like it was, you know, years before who weren't going on combat patrol, just kind of like stuck there all the time. Just like, man, how do I balance this? Because everybody wants to talk to Sergeant Major. Everybody wants to talk to Sergeant Major because Sergeant Major has great story time. That was my LPD process. I did LPDs. It's a great book. It's a character carved in stone. It's about the, if you go to West Point, the Trophy Point, you know, it's what overlooks the Hudson River. There's benches there and they have character traits carved into the back of the granolith on these things. And so I did this NCOPD, which ended up being LPD. And I would talk about like, hey, everybody knew we'd go out there on Wednesday night at, you know, 1700, 1800, whatever time it was. And it was going to be story time with Sergeant Major. I got the gift of gab and two, like I've got, you know, at the end of the day, like you start recognizing, like, as when you become an Army dinosaur, that you've got this life you've lived with all these stories to tell. And and I would tell them all the time, like, if you just listen to the story, eventually you're going to get to a point where like, oh my gosh, it took me 3 hours, but I got to the point.
That's awesome. So how did that NCOPD, like, just, you had some leaders come and just say, hey, officer, O's need to hear this too, or?
I think the SCO came to it one time, and that's basically what it was.
That's awesome.
And he's like, hey, you don't mind if everybody comes? I'm like, no, sir. I said, if it wasn't for the fact we had a mission to do, I would have brought, you know, because the way it works when you go to, when we went to OAR, you know, you have a total personnel number, a boot count on ground that you can't exceed. And so you basically took, you know, as a squadron, we basically took, you know, right around 50 to 65% of the squadron went downrange with the rest of it back in Alaska, and then it was geographically dispersed all over Iraq. The majority of the squadron was in Kirkuk at K1. Had guys over at Key West, over on, you know, just outside of Tikrit. Had guys at AAAB. Had guys up at Erbil. Had guys in Syria. You know, just you're plugging holes at that point in time. Just make sure you have people, you know, boots on the ground in the right place. But yeah, so I think I ended up having probably most of the squadron would come in, you know, NCOs. I didn't care. I mean, Joe wants to come on in, you know, it's story time with Sergeant Major, you know, and I think a lot of my peers get it. I think I think the overwhelming majority of my peers get it, but there are still some out there that just, you know, across the board from, you know, senior NCO, sergeants major, master sergeants, first sergeant, sergeant first classes. I think that when we talk about that, I think that's where the true toxicity comes, is they don't want to be involved. You know, and, you know, the cell phone is part of the problem. You have leadership through, I mean, I can only imagine what it must have been like to have been a leader stateside during COVID. Those guys that were successful, like, you know, hands down, you've got my admiration, because I didn't have to do that. I was deployed when it went out. We got to watch it on TV and be like, oh my God, is the world really on fire? Flip the Fox News. I guess it really isn't that bad. you don't know what to believe, because you just know that you're locked down on the FOB. Mm-hmm. You know, then all of a sudden we weren't allowed to have, you know, Iraqi coworkers on the FOB. And then it was like, just, and now we're down in Kuwait wearing, you know, scarves that we made over our faces and just this physical distancing stuff, whatever. And then, you know, then you redeploy from Iraq to Alaska, right? So when I redeployed to Alaska in July of 2020, I think two people in Alaska had died from COVID. You know, New York City is like, basically Manhattan is burnt to the ground.
Yeah.
Atlanta is, you know, on flames again. Sherman's come through, now known as COVID. You know, all this crazy stuff's going on. I'm in Fairbanks, Alaska, and everybody's like, what's COVID? You know, so that was my experience of COVID. Then I PCS to Hohensfels, and like all of a sudden I was back in the land of there are no rule breaking, like, vive, I'll find you.
Yeah.
You couldn't go more than 15 kilometers. At one point in time, you couldn't go more than 15 kilometers from your house.
Wow.
The good news was, like, everything was closed except for grocery stores and beer stores. I can't make that up.
And well, so that's a very German.
It was a very German thing.
And cheese and
I could go get some bread, cheese, and beer.
Yeah, and beer.
Yeah, it was. I mean, and it's. So I think I was quarantined 3 or 4 times where I had to spend, like, you know, 10 to 14 days at my house, like going on walks with my dog through the little town of Hohensfels, which is a beautiful little town. Germany is amazing. I didn't have great. There was no complaint about that. But like, hey, what am I gonna drink today for lunch? Beer.
Oh man, that reminds me of Kreuzberg. Man, that place.
It's amazing. You know, Kreuzberg is on the very edge of being a Trappist beer. So for anybody who doesn't know what Trappist beer is, Trappist beer is like the top 11 breweries in the world. I think I could be wrong with the number of 11. I think it is 11, but I think the majority of them all reside in Belgium. There's a couple of German ones, but you know, Kreuzberg is a, you know, is a beer from a monastery just off the, what used to be the Trace.
Yep.
Between East and West Germany. So it's right outside of Waalflicken, which was where I think 3rd Squadron 11th Cavalry was at, you know, and then before that it was 3rd Squadron 14th Cavalry, you know, for the border.
That's right.
We got a border guard right here.
Yeah, it was 1st and 11th.
So when we were over in Germany this last time, we were at the Nestors and we went to Bad Kissingen.
Yeah.
And I think 211 was in Bad Kissingen.
First was in Fulda.
Yeah. What was crazy is, so when I was in Schweinfurt in 2001, Daly Village was still open. So we still had an American population living in barrack, you know, living in housing there. And it's maybe 35 minutes from Schweinfurt. So not a bad drive, right? Yada, yada, yada. We closed that stuff down. My wife, we left in 2011 and we came back in 2018. The summer of 2000, I'm sorry, we got back there in 20. So the summer of 21, things open up. So my wife and I were empty nesters now, which is amazing. We go up to Bad Kissingen for a weekend. And it's been so long since there's been Americans there that every time we went someplace and we would sit at a restaurant, you know, at a beer garden drinking a beer, you know, the Germans would look at us like, holy cow, there's Americans here. It was surreal.
And Schweinfurt wasn't like that at all.
And so we went down to Schweinfurt and we linked up with Micah Johnson was there. She was in town. We were having lunch with Jeff Hodge and Patty and the kids.
Yeah.
And we're sitting at the ice cream store right off of where, you know, like the... It used to be Tabasco's on that crazy corner, right down the way from Fiddler's Green.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? So we're sitting there having ice cream, and it's exactly how it was. We're having this conversation in English, and like Germans would walk by, and they look at you, and one old-timer stopped, and in great English was like, hey, are the Americans coming back? I'm like, nah, man. It's really weird to go back to these places, you know, all these years separated.
Did you happen to walk into Fiddler's Green?
I did. I went there.
Is Mick still there?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Oh, wow.
Megan and I went back to Schweinfurt in Christmas that winter. I think it was winter 21, maybe 22. I don't remember now. It had to be 21. Hooked up with, you know, again with Jeff and Patty and Dan Grzynski. And we went down to Fiddler's, had a couple beers. It was weird because there was no Americans.
Yeah.
It was like German kids. Like, what's going on
That's
here?
That's crazy. And knowing they would have walked in there in 2011, they would have probably got their sleeves cut off by Charlie Troop.
Yeah.
That was awesome. One night, our Charlie Troop called Fiddler's Green. There's no one could have sleeves. So anytime somebody came in with sleeves, they held them down and cut off their sleeves and let them go.
Oh, my God, really?
Like, it's just, I mean, we that bar was ours. It was ours.
It absolutely was. Even before 191, when it was 1-4, it was a 1-4 hangout.
Yeah, and it's just...
You know, And Mick was a great guy. Yeah. He had a great product. It was an old bomb seller.
Yep.
You know, it just
walls looked a lot like this.
Yeah. But he had walked any steps like that. Like,
it's like poured concrete steps, cobblestone.
That was great.
I'm just curious, like, just switching gears for a second and going back into a few things, you know, talking about the readiness and then also talking about the young NCOs, you know, today and everything, you know, with fewer families having fewer kids and the whole bit, we already have the challenge. So what we do get, we have to, of course, mold and turn into our great leaders and stuff of the Army. So what kind of advice or what are you seeing that young NCOs could do to help pass that torch like you've been talking about, to make sure that tree, that family tree continues?
I think number one is be accountable for themselves and then hold their soldiers accountable. But, you know, when you hold them accountable, you know, you have to be involved. Like, you know, I remember the first time I heard it, I thought it was a bad term, but it was intrusive leadership, right? And I always thought, like, to me, the first time I heard it, I was like, man, that is like such a negative term, like intrusive, like it just sounds bad. But then you're able to hear it, you come back, do the reflection thing, you come in, and I'm like, no, intrusive leadership is parental leadership, right? You just have to be involved. You know, you can't just send your kid to school and think that the school is going to do the teaching. Yeah, the school is going to provide the backbone of this teaching, but like I'm not sure they should say the backbone. The school is going to provide the meat and potatoes, but you're the backbone, mm-hmm. NCO. When that student comes back to you, you have to be the one that reinforces it. Mm-hmm. You have to be the one that continues to train it. You're the one that sets the standard, you know, it back to regiment, you know, these six stanzas. You know, my favorite one is the G stanza. Gallantly watch over the world, I'm specially selected soldiers. My courtesy is superior officers, neatness, address, and care of equipment shall set the example for others to follow. Like I truly believe that, you know, and I try to do everything I can. Like, I mean, can I run 5 miles in 40 minutes all the time? Probably not. Why can I do it? Absolutely. You know, can I meet these physical requirements? So that young NCO, especially like the sergeant level, it's the last. You're the last fighting leadership position. You've got to lead by example. If you're going to say, hey, we're going to be here at 06 ready to do PT, then you better be there at 06 for ready for PT. If you're going to say, hey, we're going to start training at 09, you better be there at 09 and start training. That's where this legacy comes from. And then you're going to say, hey, like, first sergeant grabbed me up and took me to the DFAC. I'm going to grab you up and take you to DFAC.
The thing behind that, though, is what nobody realizes he was doing, and is he made sure we all used our meal cards.
That too.
What was he doing? He was checking to see if our sergeant went and got our meal card. Yeah. And it's like, that's, you're checking at two levels, but you're also just doing that one thing and you're making exclusive.
And so again, the doer only does with a check or check.
Yeah. Right.
So you're there. You have to be intrusive. You have to be parental, mm-hmm. you know? And so, and then the next level up above that, you know, now I'm a squad leader. I have to hold my team leaders accountable, you know? And then I gotta be, you know, I can't be a zero defect type leader, you know, mistakes of commission versus mistakes of omission. If you're busting your ass to try to do this, God dang, man, I can work with you. I can give you the tools. We can refine stuff. We can come back. We can AAR it. We can go do it again and do it again and do it again. But if you're just coming to the practice field and sitting on the sidelines, think you're going to go catch touchdown passes like freaking, you know, you name it receiver, it's not going to happen. I need you out there to run the routes.
Yeah.
I need you out there. If you're going to be Ray Lewis or Jack Lambert or anybody, you know, I need you to be out there to read the offense, to be able to understand what the offense is going to do. You know, so as a young leader, I need you to do the same thing. I need you to be a professional, you know, a master at your craft. You know, I think it's one of the issues, again, you know, that it's not like it's irreversible, but when we look at the units that are good, everybody talks sets and reps, mm-hmm. and reps. Well, the units that are good are getting great sets and having solid reps of those sets. They've figured out what they've got to do. The units that are not so good, they might be going out there and having rep after rep after rep. But if you're not trying to have the perfect practice produces perfect results, we all know it's false.
Yeah.
But if we're not trying to achieve that and holding those people accountable to get there, then we're not going to get there. And it's by example. Again, you know, I'm not going to go out and pass the RP. I'm not going to go past Ranger School today, right? I'm too broken. I'm too, just things are not right. But God dang it, if I had to go out and do that stuff today, you know, I'm going to dig down deep. You know, I'm gonna have the intestinal fortitude that's required, and I'm gonna do the mission, and I'm gonna lead by example, and hopefully, there's soldiers there that are like, holy shit, you see that old man doing that? That's why we do organizational runs, and look what we don't do as often in the United States Army right now. It's the simple stuff. It's the shining the boots.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the peer pressure of the specialist, right? Your boots were shined, my boots were not. You left the motor pool early. I stayed here and ground dry sweep into the ground, right? Hey, we used to do organizational runs. Like, I don't know what happened. Like, there's something changed. We don't do organizational runs. Why do we do organizational runs? Because the old man was in front of that bad boy, and the old man set the pace. When I was AVL 7, P people didn't want to do troop runs with Anvil 7 because Anvil 7 was going to run the dog shit out of you to prove a point. Mm-hmm. Anvil 7 was going to go back to his office and put his feet up and close the door and be left alone for a couple hours to recover.
Recover? Yeah.
But it was the point.
Yeah.
It was absolutely. It was the image. Oh. You know, it was literally the Sprite commercial. Like, image is everything. Like, I have to show you mm-hmm. right now that I'm here with you. I'm going to suck this, you know, event down with you. That just sounds so bad. That's what she said. Right. But I'm going to be a parent with you. I'm not going to allow you to do this on your own. And that's what young leaders have to do.
Sure.
I'm going to go down to the motor pool. When I took over 5-1, my very first motor pool formation, you know, it's striker land, and it's a different world because they're strikers. Formation's held, first starts to take charge, first starts to turn around, two starts to take charge, and you see this mass exodus of people heading towards the gate, and you see this few guys going towards the stuff. I'm like, whoa, hey, first sergeants, come here, what's going on? Well, those are all the crew. They're going to go do ancillary equipment, and they're all the dismounts. They're going to go do this, and these guys are going to go work on strikers. I'm like, no. That striker's was going to take you to combat. That striker's was going to help you survive in combat. That striker's going to be your home for everybody. Everybody's down here. And what really irritated me that morning is I was watching staff sergeants and platoon sergeants walk out. I'm like, oh no. So I brought all the platoon. I remember this discussion like it was yesterday. Had all the platoon sergeants in one of the motor pool bays. I said, hey, when it comes time for us to rack and stack you, I want you to understand that if your OR rate for your platoon is 6 of 6, you're in this pile to be amongst the best. If you're 4, 3, 2, or 1, or 0 of 6, because your maintenance is not good, your readiness is horrible, you're never going to be over here. And I had one of them like, well, that's not fair, Sergeant Major. These are the oldest strikers in the world. They are. But I'm pretty certain on your NCOER, there's a bullet in there that says you're responsible for the morale, welfare, and maintenance of X, right? So many sergeants, so many staff sergeants, so many soldiers.
So many $1 million worth of equipment.
So many $1 million worth of equipment.
Yeah.
The ones that got it. And yeah. Their platoons were amazing. Their platoons were too tight. They were organized. They were well-trained. You know, they were a family within a family. You know, and that's... So that going back to Anvil Troop, and what I think young leaders need to understand too is I take over the troop. The guy that was there before me was an infantryman, right? So he was 11 Zulu. And in the world of cavalry, top is an honor that's bestowed upon you because you're the top NCO. It's in our world, that's a good term. And the infantry world, for some reason, and I don't think it used to be this way, is it's a derogatory term. So first sergeant wouldn't allow the troop to call him top. So the very first thing I said when I took over, you know, at the change of responsibility, was like, you can call me top, right? Like, it's okay. Well, that was fine. My oldest daughter at the time was, I think, 16 or 17, was back from college. And when she wanted something from me, she would call me papa. Like, hey, Papa, can I get the car, Papa? Well, one of our esteemed colleagues, who's now a first sergeant, Alex Fascia, was in my training room. He was my combo NCO, and he heard that. And somehow, some way, that became my endearing name for the troop. But I was okay with it because I also believed in, you know, it's so bad because he's now a bad guy, but Bill Cosby's one line, right? And that was, you know, he thought for years that his brother's name was Jesus Christ and his name was Goddamn, because his dad would always be like, Jesus Christ, Goddamn it, right? And so, but the point was, dad could call you whatever he wanted to because he was dad, mm-hmm. right? So I, as a first sergeant, and then a lot of my peers totally disagree with this, called everybody by the first name. Right. I was on first name basis with you because it drove me nuts that the officers would always do it. Right. And we never did it. And I always felt like me calling you specialist or me calling you Neil or me calling you whatever was disingenuous. Like it didn't get after what I was trying to do, this family thing.
And it helped us to be able to read a room too, because if you called me PFC Neil, I was pucker factor a million. They call me Kyle. Like,
and that was part of it.
Yep.
And I had my sergeant major could not get past that at the time. He just didn't understand. I'm like, sergeant major, I want you to understand this. Like, I'm
what are
Jake.
You doing, Hammerhead?
right? I'm Jake. When I'm in trouble, I was Jacob. If I was in big trouble, I was Jacob Edward Stockdale. Mm-hmm. Like, I can hear it from my grandmother. I can hear it from my mom. I can hear it from my wife today.
Yeah.
You know, and I did the same thing. So, like, you nailed it. If I walked into a room and I was like, hey, private, you knew right then and there that it wasn't time to look up and be like, hey, what's up, First Sergeant? It was, you better get to parade rest and be prepared for what's coming next. And I thought it worked, you know, it was parental leadership.
Yeah.
We did another one of my most proudest moments of my First Sergeant time is we did a holiday party before we deployed to Afghanistan in 2010. I had all the turkeys and ham and all this other stuff done at the DFAC. I worked really well with all the German, the contractors in there. I think we did like 5 turkeys and 5 hams, you know, who knows how many pounds of potatoes, but you know, all that stuff. But we had the dinner at the elementary school in the cafeteria at the mm-hmm. elementary school in Schweinfurt, Germany. And there was 100% attendance from the troop.
Yep.
100% attendance. The squadron commander and sergeant major came in there and they were like, they were dumbfounded by the fact that there was 100%. And it was the same thing for the ball.
Mm-hmm.
We were the only troop that had 100% attendance to the cavalry ball. The brigade commander, he even said something to me. He's like, First Sergeant, your tables are twice the number of tables of any, like, we had half the ballroom. He's like, what's going on? I said, sir, they know we roll deep. You know, when we go out, we don't, it's like, I get, what's the soccer team? Is it Manchester? We'll never walk alone.
Mm-hmm. Manchester United.
Man United. Yeah. We'll never walk alone. Like, I didn't know that was a thing, but that was one of the things that Anvil Troop did. Like, you're never going to go out by yourself.
Ask the bouncers at the mat about Anvil Troop.
Yeah. You were never going to go to the, you were never going out by yourself. You were always going to be with a battle buddy.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, I never used the term battle buddy. I hated it. Yeah. Cause I heard it so much, but you were going to go out with your family. And that's how it was, you know, so that, full circle, long way. That's what young leaders need to understand. Like, it's okay to be intrusive,
yeah,
parental, and be involved with your soldiers. It's not just talking on a cell phone. And it's not, you know, it's not just texting like, hey, what's going on? It's being there. It's checking on them in the morning. And then once you know that, then that's where the readiness comes in. Cause then mm-hmm. I can recognize like, hey man, like I can tell you're not feeling good today. Like, what's going on? Yeah. You know, the wife and I had a fight last night. Okay. Do you need some time? And that's the next one. Like, you know, recognizing that sometimes we have to give the time to make sure, because like right now, I'll go back in time. When I came in 96, you know, you would look around and you would see, you know, every once in a while you'd see a guy with a right shoulder patch, you know, combat patch, shoulder sleeve insignia, former wartime service. They were very few and far between. Then all of a sudden 2001 happened, 2003 happened. And then the only person that didn't have a combat patch was the new guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the new guy was a private, a second lieutenant. Go to a formation today. Like go to the captain's career course, or, you know, there's one or two combat patches.
Wow.
Everything old was new. Mm-hmm. Right. And so these, same thing. Like, hey man, like you just got to bring them in. You got to be part of the family. Cause at some point in time, the Army is going to ask you to do something that is probably against everything you're brought up with, your values, right? I'm going to ask you to take a weapon and use it to end another human being's life. Whether that's being the terminal controller of a bomb dropping, whether that's you slinging a mortar, or whether you're the guy pulling a trigger at point blank, it's going to happen. So I've got to give you the time. That's another one. Like, I was a firm believer in 1700, right? 1700, when the flag goes down, you go home. I say it all the time, because we're in Germany. When we lower the flag down of our country on another country's sovereign territory and thank it for its service during the day and fold it up and put it away and say, thank you, flag, you should be going home too. Because at some point in time, I'm going to ask you to stay until 2000
mm-hmm.
or 2200, or I'm going to ask you to come in at 02 to get on a bus to drive 3 hours to Grafenwehr to sit in freaking a bullshit hangar for 3 hours with a chute on, fully know you're not going to jump because it's torrentially downpouring. But I'm going to ask you to do it. And I'm going to ask you to miss, you know, a soccer game, a wife's birthday, you know, whatever it is, I'm going to ask you to miss it. So I got to be the intrusive parental leader to know what's going on, to give you the time when, and that, that'll build the readiness. I mean, it's a symbiotic cycle of life. I mean, it really is. Like Simba's dad, Mufasa. He nailed it, man. It's a circle of life, you know, and that's what I'm part of. Like I'm an army dinosaur. I'm a whole lot closer to being oil than I ever was an egg. Right. It's going to happen. I'm going to go in army terms. I'm going to go away and somebody else has to pick up the mantle. And, you know, hopefully we're able to do that. And I think the army in general is a good place. We got some tweaking to do and it's a leadership problem. It's a leadership issue. It's not a leadership problem. We got some stuff we got to work out. You know, the results of policy that took place, like, in, you know, of who we allowed in, what we're doing for the, you know, the army structure today, where we're going to go, what are we mm-hmm. really trying to do? You know, what's our mission? You know, it's, I think it happens all the time.
It was clearly defined before 9/11, right? Our enemy is communism. Our enemy is the Russians. We are still running off of, you know.
And Chinese.
But our foreign policy was roughly the same since the end of World War II, was stop the spread of communism.
Yeah. It was the Cold War.
The Cold War, yeah. And so.
Everything has its, like you're saying, everything has its cycle.
Yeah. What is our foreign policy at this point?
Yeah.
Well, I know what our imminent threat and our near peer threats are. You know, obviously our pacing threat is the Chinese, and mm-hmm. you know, our imminent threat is the Russians in Europe, mm-hmm. right? So we know that, and of course we still have the same non-state actors.
Yeah,
you know, I'm incredibly curious. Just as an army parent, you know, it's another one of these things where it's a different outlook. Like my daughter's already been to combat. You know, obviously it's not the same combat that we experienced, but she's you know, she got the experience, things going boom in the night,
yeah.
you know, and having that, you know, then having the CVRAMs go off mm-hmm. and all the other stuff. So she has an understanding of what it means to a certain degree. But with like the conflicts we have going on right now, like I'm incredibly curious what's going to happen in the Middle East with Israeli and the Gaza stuff. But you know what I mean? Like it's interesting. Again, like from a mm-hmm. guy who's in the Army perspective, yeah. and you know, trying to be a .mil PF integrator and looking at the future formations and how we're going to maintain, you know, these things against our pacing threat, and what's the right formation, mm-hmm. what's the right weapon, what's the right platform, you know, that's, you're able to put yourself in a box that allows you to see it from just a, hey, we're going to go do this. Then from the dad perspective, it's like, hey man, like this could be one of my kids, you know, being on this platform. I mean, hopefully we get it right.
Yeah.
This could be one of my kids that's going to go and fight this. Hopefully get the right doctrine right. Hopefully we have the right foreign policy, you know, because I'm about to make that transition completely, and then I won't have a say,
yeah.
you know, at all. So it's troubling, curious, you know, I just confusing, you know, a lot of Americans, like, you know, so many of our, you know, our patriotic, you know, citizens don't even know what it's like to leave the county they live in.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's not their fault. It's just the reality. I mean, this country is massive. Like, you know, all of Europe fits in the East Coast kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Well, Jake, we could probably go on for hours, but somebody asked us to mention something, put you on the spot.
So there was a picture on social media.
Yeah.
May have made a certain page.
So was it Mike or was it Sean?
One said it and one corroborated it.
Yeah.
It's totally true.
Yeah. So you just went in there and just laid down, obviously you weren't sleepy. It was
So when you go to this, this class, you go to the one auditorium, it's affectionately known as the master bedroom. Right, because you spend hours in there, and it's hot because of the geographic location where you are. And you listen to guest speakers speak on and on and on. And at some point in time, it's the same thing over. It's nothing against my peers, my superiors, non-commissioned officers, the higher division and higher level. But when we talk about leadership, it generally ends up being the same thing. Don't do what I did, do this, right? General officers the same way. So you master bedroom. And we're generally, my class for this place was pretty full. Right. Well, at one point in time, a lot of our classmates were gone because they were doing another event. And so there's tons of room in there. And so I made a joke of saying, look, man, there's so much room in here for other activities. Like I could literally lay down and take a nap. And so everybody's like, haha, that's funny. I'm like, yeah, no, check it out. Look, Boom. And I laid down like I was taking a nap on the floor between the seats. Someone took a picture of it. Hmm. I had the picture. I never did anything with it. I just had it. So go through the course of the year, get to another semester. We take our class photo, and our class photo I thought was a bag of ass. Like it was terrible, and it came out and didn't look good. And one of the instructors, who was a retiree, was making fun of us. And I was like, "You want to see a picture that really shows what the academy is? Here it is." And so I showed it to him, and the people in my small group are like, "Oh my God, that's the funniest thing ever! Like it really is the master bedroom." It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon on like a Tuesday. I posted it to my Facebook account saying, "I'm so tired, I could sleep anywhere." Boom. I left class that day. I went to the pool and swam my PT, went back to my house, you know, to my apartment, did some other stuff. It's now like 1900 at night. I pick up my phone, you have the banners that come across, and it's like, "So-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so liked your post." Well, all these so-and-sos were like senior people.
Senior so-and-sos.
Senior so-and-sos. Mm-hmm. Like when I say senior seniors, I mean like a couple of them couldn't get any more senior.
Like of the army types.
Yeah. If you pick it up what I'm putting down. I'm like, "Holy shit, man." So I open it up. I'm like, "Oh my God, I have like, you know, every person on my Facebook is like this thing." And the comments are classic. Like, "Yeah, dude, that's exactly how it was for me. That's hilarious. Blah, blah, blah." I'm like, "Man, I gotta take this down." So I take it down.
Yeah.
Gone. The next morning I come back to class, and one of my classmates is like, "Hey man, you made what the fuck moments." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He goes, your post made WTF. I'm like, "There's no way." So computer log in, boom, there it is. It had something like 10,000 likes and some, like it had gone viral. Mm. And so I immediately go to the leadership of the place. I'm like, "Hey man, like I did not do this. I posted it to my personal Facebook," and yeah, it blew up.
No repercussions or no blowback?
No, there was totally repercussions. I got a negative counseling statement for it. I was removed from the commandant's list. I couldn't have any honors from the class. I think at that point in time, I was well within the top 20% of my class. Mm-hmm. So I had this negative counseling, and I didn't get all excellences on my 1059, but I mean, I still made sergeant major. I still get to be a squadron sergeant major. I still get to be a brigade sergeant major. So yeah. Like it was one of those moments. Like I think, and I said this all the time, if you can't have a little bit of humor in your life, you can't laugh at yourself, and then maybe you need to be doing something different. If you're not having fun doing this, because at the end of the day, like I've talked about, it, we can be very serious. We can talk about the no shit, what we're going to do, but God dang, man. Like, Festivus for the rest of us was fun.
It was.
The steak eating contest at freaking, I mean, think about this. I mean, we followed up the steak eating contest with a warm pudding eating contest with no hands.
This is the same guy that jumped off a bird at OP Spur dressed as Santa Claus to deliver Christmas dinner to the guys one of the guys that was on the OP.
Yeah.
Like you got to have fun with it.
You got to have fun with it. If you can't have fun with it. And that was one of my things. When I left, you know, El Paso, I just remember thinking to myself, like, man, it's one of those moments, like, I'm not going to be that sergeant major. Mm-hmm. So I go back to like what I was not prepared for the accessibility of being a sergeant major. But then at the same time, I was like, you know what? This is cool. I'm down with this. Like I am open to spreading the message. If I'm going to be the guy who's a subject matter expert of this stuff, of cavalry and reconnaissance, you know, reconnaissance security operations, then by God, I'll be it. If I'm going to be the master gunner here and I'm going to have to do this thing, then I'll be it. You know, if I'm going to be the one that has to tell the war story so people understand what this is going to be, it's never a war story of like, "Oh, look at me. Look, I'm look at the glory that I went and had." Like I'm not, you know, doing the final assault on a fort in Charleston, South Carolina. You know, I'm not doing Pickett's charge. You know, I did what my country asked me to do, and I want you to understand what that might entail. But like, I'll be the guy, and I'm gonna have fun doing it. If that's probably my number one downfall in the United States Army is I want to have fun. I want to be funny. I think everybody should laugh. I think there should be levity in every meeting. You know, unless of course we're talking. Like, "Hey, Russia just launched nuclear missiles." okay, maybe we shouldn't laugh about that. But you know what I mean? Like, there's, yeah, you should be able to find, you know, if we talk about resiliency. We should be able to hunt the good stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
In everything, all the time. And if you're not able to do it, then it's just, it's not fun. And if it's not fun, you're not going to be good at it. You can't tell me that Travis Kelce and freaking Patrick Mahomes and all those guys out there aren't having the best time of their life on the field. When he threw that pass backwards, good God, man, everybody had fun. I don't care who you rooted for. Mm-hmm. You're like, holy shit, that was the best play I've ever seen. And then you're like, God dang, that dude was offsides. But nobody does it. You can't tell me that the astronauts who went to the moon weren't having a, like, you know what was going on in that.
Yeah.
I mean, we talk about what goes on in the turret, stays in the turret. You know, that there's stories that we'll never get from Neil Armstrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, because he probably shit in somebody's face during the thing. He was like, oh, look at that. Teabagged you. You know, hopefully they didn't do that.
I kind of hope they did.
They probably did.
You know what I mean? Like,
they probably did, because you got to have fun. So, like, that was my takeaway from when I left the Sergeant Major's Academy after that posted. Like, I could not believe that this blew up that bad. We're at our final spring social event in the Sergeant Major of, like, the two of the top Sergeant Majors there. Like, you know, we're asking, hey, Sergeant Stockdale or Master Sergeant Stockdale, you know, having a good time? Yeah. And the one of them looks at me and goes, hey, man, that carpet looks really comfortable. I'm like, holy shit, man. Like high five, Sergeant Major, because you got it.
Yep.
You boom, you totally understood what was going on here. And I have peers that were like the two you mentioned, they know. They know that there was not trying to shame the academy, or, you know, I was trying to diminish the rank or the prestige of what we're doing. I was just having a good time. We're just, hey, man, the most dangerous crew in the world is a crew full of sergeants. You know what's more dangerous than that? A crew full of sergeants major, right? Because at the end of the day, we're all privates, right? I got the best job I've done in my 28 years of the Army was to be an OC, to be a Sergeant Major OC as Grizzly 04 in Hohenzollern, Germany, right? They literally gave me a truck and Private Stockdale got behind the wheel every time he drove. by myself.
Yeah.
Jake, I hope you keep having fun for these last few years that you've got. Man, I appreciate
17 months.
Yeah. Oh, well, see, there you go. Short time. You're already counting the days and everything. But I appreciate you coming up and sharing these amazing stories and words of wisdom, you know, that you've dropped here. Love to have you back.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that we can drop more nuggets of good stuff.
Yeah.
If you're open to
nuggets,
that.
Golden nuggets and knowledge. That's another Steven Zebarthism. Golden nuggets and knowledge.
Well, appreciate you, man. Driving the motorcycle up.
Oh, it's never a drag ride, you know. Yeah. So I just, you know, obviously I ride with CVMA, another great organization, mm-hmm. that, you know, for vets helping vets. You know, that's what it's all about. You know, and I think if we help our vets, you know, have a better message, mm-hmm. you know, we're all going to be recruiters for the United States Army. You know, or the Marine Corps, or the Navy, you know, beat Navy, but, you know, they're it's all of vital importance if we're going to do what we're supposed to do to have this country maintain what it's supposed to be, this beacon of democracy and freedom for the world. Then we've got to have a military that's able to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, right? So,
appreciate it.
We're all recruiters.
That's perfect.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much for coming.